We're here with Alexander Hurgitt.
That's right.
And man, it's the 14th of March, 2019. We're on planet Earth here in the central coast of Australia. And I really want to thank you, man, for taking the time to come and do this interview. And I'd like to thank Robert Hogenbaum for introducing us. But look, tell us a little bit about yourself. Where you're from originally, how long you've lived in Australia, what exactly you do. You're equal parts, as I understand it, political activist, nutritional educator, and filmmaker. And all around good guy. But so tell us a little bit of your background and how you came to be here now.
All right. Well, I'm born in Germany. I'm born in Cologne. That was obviously a long time ago. I've lived for the first 17, 18 years in Germany, finished my schooling there, and then I kind of felt I wanted to travel. I did a round the world trip and kind of really, I always liked to travel beforehand, but it really ignited my love for the world, for people, stories, and just seeing what's happening outside of, you know, where you kind of grew up and where you're living. So after that, I decided to enroll into a film course because I was really interested in terms of learning the craft of really storytelling and filmmaking, and I wanted to look behind the curtains, you know, behind the camera, what's happening. So I enrolled in Australia. I looked at a couple of different things. I kind of went to Canada and Los Angeles, but I ultimately found Australia to be a really nice place. It seemed to be nice people, seemed to be of good climate, and everything seemed nice. So I decided for Australia, so I enrolled into the Academy of Photogenic Arts, or International Film School, and did my diploma in cinematography there. After that, I enrolled into the Australian Film and Radio Television School. I did editing course there, and then I started to do my. I had a production company with a few guys, which we started making commercials, short films. We made a short film called Spoon Man, which won Best Australian Short Film. It was it went around the world. It was very successful, highly acclaimed, and then I started making bigger projects, and it went all very well until then the financial crisis hit in 2007-08. A lot of the projects that we've done fell apart. You know, I went back to Germany. Everything was kind of falling apart, and I had to kind of regain a little bit of that strength. I had a lot of time to reflect. Went into really, why do I want to be in the film industry? Why do I want to tell stories? Because I didn't want to just make commercial films that really didn't appeal to me, to be told what to tell and to be told what to write. So I kind of left that field and went into medicine, exploring the human body, physiology, studied nutrition medicine. Yeah, and went into that field, and I had a lot of Border Healing Center in Australia, came back to Australia, Border Healing Center, ran that for 2 years. I learned a lot about people, about health, but at the same time, I was very tied up in the business, so the administration of it was really something that I didn't really it helped me back in other ways, so I didn't have time to do my project, so I sold that again. And then I started really, there was a couple of trigger moments for me. It's about justice. I was always interested. Look, I've studied philosophy as well at some point in Germany, social psychology, and I was always interested in what makes people, you know, take action. Why do people stand up in certain countries, not in others? So I kind of tried to really investigate that, and I was really always looking at the political arena in terms of, I can't believe that Julian Assange arrested, these guys, you know, the press is not writing about this, but writing about that. So I kind of really looked more and more into it and started then to become more active. Yeah, and go to protests, forming my own opinion on things, researching, reading papers that I learned on university, of course, understanding what a study is, reading scientific papers.
So it sounds like you began to make a transition from letting outside forces dictate what you thought and believed to being more of a critical thinker and seeking more for the truth behind the surface appearances that we're presented with.
Yeah, I would say that, look, Truth is difficult, I guess, because there's sometimes it's a bit organic as well, because we want to believe things, and then when you realize that it might be different, it is hard sometimes to really understand what the real truth of any subject is, and it requires a lot of work to actually find that out. Because
it's an ongoing process.
Oh, yeah.
As I understand it, you're not going to all of a sudden arrive at the truth, and then there's nowhere else to go.
Unless it's Pythagoras.
Yes. Well, now in filmmaking, to me, one of the most interesting schools of filmmaking is what you call cinema verite, which is it means filming the truth. You know what that is?
When you film
stuff that's actually happening, and the people or the things being filmed don't even know they're being filmed. You know, so it's like it's not being staged or orchestrated or anything.
Yeah.
Always thought that was a very interesting.
Look, it's actually quite interesting, and why I was attracted to filmmaking, why I do believe actually there's a real resurgence of filmmaking, is because we are actually surrounded by non-empathetic cameras. So we are surrounded by surveillance, we're surrounded by people with phones which don't have any empathy for the subject. And I think that is a very dangerous thing, because they're not telling the whole story. So for example, nowadays we look at the news and almost everything that happens has a video clip with it. You know, someone robs a store.
And if they didn't actually film it, then they'll make one up.
Yeah, exactly. So they just, you know, have a little stock library, and then like, oh, let's put this one up. And I think, or they make one up. Yeah, that's right. But I think what's important is to, I was drawn to documentary filmmaking, I guess, because first of all, the truth is always a great story. And
why is that?
Because,
I mean, it's not a rhetorical question.
Yeah.
It's because it's the truth.
Because it's the truth, that's right. It's compelling, and it's authentic, and people respond to that. You don't have to make believe. And people kind of attract it. So you get away with, non-polished filmmaking, I guess, if you have a good content, a good subject that is actually,
and that people can relate with and identify with.
Yeah.
Well, what about the foisting of untruth? And that as an industrial tendency in mass media, or partial truth.
Yeah.
I mean, that's another whole story in itself. But
What I find interesting is, like, because obviously I'm a native speaker. Well, I speak different languages, so I could very much when I'm observing my German in the news, and then Australian news, and America, and they will actually be doing the same story in all the countries. Like, it's very funny. Like, so some stories are kind of... So there's actually obviously only three main news agencies in the world that provide the stories.
And what would those be?
Well, DPA, Reuters is one of the big ones. And then there is obviously the BBC. They have they have their own reporters on the ground sometime.
What's DPA?
Deutsche Presseagentur.
Okay.
Yeah. They have quite a big network around the globe. And they would supply stories via newspapers. You have a portal where you go in the morning and you look up what stories are. So then you pick one that you like, or what you've been told to like, and you pick the story up, and yeah, you just basically either write up a story from it or take the story over. I mean, or steal stories, right? I mean, that's what a lot of the news agencies in Australia do.
Whoever gets the lead, who breaks the story first.
Well, that's actually not true anymore.
Really?
No. Whoever gets first gets copied first. So, for example, there are really good reporters investing that they put the story up. Someone like News Limited will take that story and publish it on their thing, and they will break the story because they have the platform.
Yeah.
They got the views. So the person that actually originally brought the story wouldn't even be mentioned. So it's quite common, actually.
Well, but if your goal is to share the truth and reality, then I don't care.
Sure, but at the same time, obviously you depend on...
You've got to get some credit somehow.
You have to somehow get credit and get also be remunerated for your story, so they don't even pay the person.
Like, yes.
You know, it'd be fine if they're saying, look, we take your story, we give you $200 for the story, so you can do the next one.
And some people may be penalized for breaking a story. directly or indirectly, totally. Especially when you're talking about touchy subjects and controversial issues and stuff like that. Well, let me ask you this. You said that you're very interested in justice. Now, define a little more about what you mean and the relationship between justice and truth.
Yeah.
As you said.
Well, there's sometimes, obviously, correlation between the two. Not always. For example, the big problem that I see at the moment is that certain things are just, but the truth of it is that they are not necessarily good. So we are living in a society that are governed by laws that some people know how to circumvent and make it work for them. So they are just in that what they're doing.
Well, yeah, technically.
Technically.
But not morally or
I know, so
ethically.
So we have a really... It's a definition again, and it's an individual definition of what is your moral, what do you consider to be justice and what someone else. So there, I guess there's a court system and they again are looking at justice, interpreting the law, because it's not actually, you know, people sometimes don't understand what actually justice is. A law has to be applied to a real life scenario, and the judge has to make a judgment on if that law was broken or not broken in that particular way, and that becomes a precedent for other people. So it's a very organic actually field
and a lucrative industry.
Oh yeah, I mean the amount of money that is spent on lawyers, in litigation.
Absolutely,
it's crazy.
Now let me ask you about this. You guys just organized. I'm not sure if you were involved with it or not. A large protest here a week or two ago about some offshore seismic exploration for gas that wants to happen. So tell us about that and why. Tell us about your attitude towards protest. You've said you participated in protests before or organized them. Now, how do you see that as what will that accomplish? What would you hope to accomplish?
Yeah. One, I think for me, really, it's about community building. So that's something that is what they're planning here with the offshore gas and oil exploration. It really has brought out a lot of people from the community.
Yes. Now, tell us in a nutshell, what is it that's being planned and who wants to do it?
So there is a company, Western Australian company, that has bought the exploration rights to actually establish an oil and gas industry on the Central Coast.
And what are they called?
The Advent Energy.
Now, I thought there was a Norwegian company involved.
That's
too.
Actually down in the in South Australia.
Okay.
Divide. Yeah,
okay.
That's Equinor.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So it's the same thing, different company, different region.
Yeah.
But basically, they want to establish a big oil and gas industry, or here's particular gas, to extract the gas reserves and then to pump it back into the mainland or offshore, I guess.
Would part of this project be involved building a shore-based infrastructure for the tankers and stuff?
I strongly suggest that, yes. Yeah.
And so was this the first protest that you guys have organized?
No, there's been a lot of protests going on over the last years.
And so where does the approval of these permits and stuff, where does that stand right now?
So we have at the moment an application of amendment at NOCTA, which is the regulator in terms of the permits. Once that has been granted, they have to submit an environmental plan to NOPSEMA. Once NOPSEMA is happy that the company has taken in consideration all the environmental risk, they will grant that for 3D seismic testing, which again is a very invasive testing method to establish where to drill and where the gas reserves are. Once they've done that, they will do a test drill as part of that seismic testing, and then they will potentially go into full-scale production very shortly after that.
So is it the seismic testing per se that you primarily object to?
It's one of the major things, but we object to actually establishing a gas industry.
That's the most immediate danger.
Yeah, the immediate danger is seismic testing that has an immediate impact on the marine life.
Now tell us about that as you understand it.
As I understand it, there are quite large arrays of air guns that shoot at about 250 decibel every 15 seconds. Into the ground, and then obviously waiting for the return of those waves, and they somehow be able then to make some assumptions about the groundwork and in terms of the deposits there. And obviously there is no real surveys, no real observation under the water of what's happening. Because when you think about it, like if you have heard an air horn, you know, in a stadium or anywhere, about 250 decibel will be 16,000 times louder than that. It's actually an exponential scale.
Absolutely.
So it's just not understandable.
And sound travels much more intensely in water.
Four times faster.
And plus, we just can't. I mean, it's like, you know, though, anybody that lives in the ocean, they're in a much denser medium, so they're going to feel. It won't just be a sound, it'll be a shockwave felt with their whole body.
Oh, yeah. I mean, even if you are just in the vicinity of a whale, and the whale would sing, you will feel it in your whole body, the vibration of the actual sounds it makes. I mean, you can. I think when you... Have you ever been next to a really big speaker, and you can see the bass and how it actually penetrates you, and actually your heart starts to beat with the beat of the drum.
The entrainment.
Yeah. So it's actually your whole physiology adapts to the vibration. So... if we, for example, look at a jet starting, actually the end of a gun, if you ever had someone take a gun off next to you, if you're right next to the end of the gun, it's 180 dB. So, again, look at it, again, thousands of times more louder than that. So I don't recommend anyone being close by when those air guns going off. But yeah, there seems to be thinking that it's safe. I don't know how anyone can think that, but obviously they're looking at, you know, what we're really questioning at the moment is the regulators' lack of duty of care in terms of stating reasonable risk to the environment. So what is reasonable?
Well, there's this thing called the precautionary principle.
Exactly, that's what we just heard today.
You must err on the side of caution.
Yes,
we can't. You must assume that it would be dangerous until proven that it's not, rather than the opposite.
Yeah, and in this case, for some reason, it's actually, I don't quite understand how it's possible, because if I'm in the law, they have to prove that I did something. But in this case, it's on, and the burden of proof is on the fishers.
It's asymmetrical.
So we're questioning that, and we actually going after that, because I don't think, because they couldn't tell us, is that one lobster death reasonable? 1,000? 1,000,000?
And now, who is this telling you this?
The mayor actually is quite supportive of our action of the Central Coast.
What is her name?
Jane Smith.
Okay.
Yeah. So she is very active and very supportive of the action against it. The council has come out unanimously rejecting the proposal. She told also about the precautionary
principle,
which is actually in our legal statutes. So I don't know why they're not applying it, and we should test it in terms of the Supreme Court, because I reckon a judge, I mean, how can it be possible? I don't know. It's really disheartening.
Well, I'll tell you, just as a tiny little tidbit that relates, one of the most horrific stories I've ever heard in Australia was there was a band called Men at Work, and they did this song called The Land Down Under. You know the song?
Yep.
Do you know the story of that? There was a guy who plotted for years. That kookaburra sits in the old gum tree was always sort of a gift to Australia from the Melbourne school teacher who wrote it back in the 1930s. She let anybody record it. It was like her gift, and she owned it, but she never required licensing or anything. Well, this dude plotted to gain control of the licensing for that song, so that years after Men at Work had made a lot of money on that song, he then sued them for violation of his copyright license, and won because the judge approved it. And that's a very short nutshell of the story, but that's an example of how an obviously corrupt judge that participated in the spoils of the deal. You know, so that the whole what we're talking about is notorious for that kind of behind the scenes thing. It's probably a given. But you can't. You can only delve into that so far, because if you start throwing around accusations like that, you're going to
end up with a defamation against it.
But even if it's true.
I know.
Even if it's true.
And that's, I think, one of the major things as a investigative journalist, I guess, which I've participated, that you're not even allowed to tell the truth. Like, the publishers are scared.
Say that again.
You're not even allowed to tell the truth. The truth gets you in trouble.
It's never been popular, has it?
No. And people are scared of it. Because that's why...
It can be quite inconvenient for a lot of Apple carts might get turned over.
Very much so. And I mean, the dust, you know, no one wants to, you know, bring up the dust. You know?
There was a one of the biggest, until modern day, modern times, one of the biggest hoaxes in the history of sciences was called the Neanderthal Man. It came from the Neander Valley in Germany, where, mm-hmm. where it all happened. But these college students created these fake bones that they allowed this scientist to discover. And he instantly proclaimed it to be the fair dinkum missing link he had looked for all these years. And overnight, it was declared, and it went in all the textbooks and stuff. And finally, about 30 years later, these guys came out and showed the photographs that proved that they had faked all this stuff. And it took decades for it all to get out of the textbooks because people didn't want to admit.
What? Didn't that. Happen?
They didn't want to admit that they bought into it, you know.
Yeah.
They had, you know, so it's like.
Well, there's a classic thing, you know, for the truth to come, for new knowledge to have to come at university. Not only the students, not only the professors have to die, but the students too, right? So.
Well, it's a transgenerational thing.
Yeah, sure.
So now, do you really love the whales?
I think they're magnificent beings, and I feel there is a really transcendental, like an almost mythical, magical presence about them.
Have you been up to them very close?
I've been on a boat. I haven't been swimming with them, but I've been probably a few meters away from a big humpback whale.
Yes.
Up on in Hervey Bay. In Australia, and just the sound, just the sheer power of them is. Yeah, I think anyone that has been close to them would
it changes,
be cured.
It changes you.
It. I think if we could just get people into the water with them, that would change their heart.
So what about the global hydrocarbon scenario? Mm. Because I was going to bring up something that even if you guys are able successfully to thwart this project, they're just going to do it somewhere else.
Yeah.
And I did an interview with a guy at the University of Georgia around 1990. His name was Dr. Eugene Odum, O-D-U-M. He's credited as being the father of modern ecology.
Mm-hmm.
And he used an expression called NIMBYs.
Mm-hmm.
N-I-M-B-Y. It stands for not in my backyard.
Yeah.
You can go and do it over there. Go and dispose of your radioactive waste over there. Go and drill over there, but not in my backyard.
Yeah.
You know, so there. You know, that it's something to look at. And,
totally.
And plus, we're all, what we call civilization, is hopelessly dependent on hydrocarbon fuels.
Yeah. We really love hydrocarbon, you know.
We're addicted to it.
They're everywhere. Wherever you look, we're sitting on hydrocarbons.
Exactly. Everything that's planted.
You're filming on hydrocarbons.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I admit, I'm actually thankful for what some of the stuff we have. I have contact lenses that are made of plastic.
There you go. Yeah.
But would you say that the problem is with anything that we've taken from the earth, anything that we do, the problem that we've created is not necessarily with the thing itself, but it's the level that we have to take it to. We can't stop with just some. We've got to go, and part of it's the capitalistic imperative, but we can't stop with just a little bit. We've got to just go more and more and more.
Look, I think there is also a problem of distribution. I do believe that if the political will would be there, I mean, there have been leaders that have created things that were not popular, but in the long run has created change. So I think we need to look at more sustained, I guess, I look at a circular economy as a good idea. At the moment, we have a linear economy now, so we have to always do more to work, and we have to consume more. And in a finite world, to me, that's madness. So if we would create a circular economy where at the time of creation of a product, you actually need to have a plan for the end of the cycle to create another product or to update that product, I think that would, again, probably has consequences for jobs and this and that and for companies, but maybe in the end would be a better concept. I believe there is promising new ideas.
Yes.
And I think they can be implemented. If they can be implemented fast enough for us to stop destruction, I don't know. Can they implement it in a fair way that no one exploited? It's difficult with our human nature because my experience is there's always going to be someone that wants more, someone that is just not happy to play you know, properly, you know, above board. There's always people that want to circumvent the system to grow the system. So
yes, what an example of a circular economic development be if we were able to. And I'm not saying this just as a joke. If we were able to create nutritional products from feces, because we'd be recycling our poopy.
Well, there is actually a very interesting thing where you get actually shit from a very healthy person and you get it implanted into you, and that actually creates a good gut health for you. So there are these things that's happening. So there is people with good shit, and if you eat that shit,
you're supposed to eat it.
Well, actually, it's been a bit more medical. It's going to get inserted in a little suppository.
Oh,
gets
my
inserted
God.
Into
well,
you.
That's so funny.
But it's true. It's happening.
Well, 100 phosphine loads.
They're called feces transplant, I guess. Yeah. So look, there's a lot of good stuff in feces, and I'm totally. I think it's ridiculous that we flush it away, and then with drinking water,
yes,
and then
absolutely.
Transported with pumping and everything
into
the recycling plant.
No,
that would be actually better. Well, it's not good either because of the nitrogen and everything, but it's transported into in plants and water cleaning plants, and it gets cleaned by chemicals. So it can be put back into the wood. I mean, I don't know. It seems to be really a strange concept.
Well, it's a form of dementia.
Yeah.
Well, but how about this? Mm-hmm. How do you explain humanity's obsession with gold? Because to me, really healthy poopy is actually more valuable than gold in terms of its actual use value.
Well, maybe piss actually is even more valuable.
Well,
because it has a very high phosphorus content. And if we could just collect the pee, which is also gold, I guess. Gold might be the new gold.
Liquid gold.
Liquid gold. Everybody better just mine that.
Absolutely.
You want to take a piss? Wait a second. Can you put that into this glass for me, please?
But Gandhi was the first person to actually take the piss.
Well, actually, there's a whole medical in a urine therapy, you know, as well, because there's actually a lot of immunology that is created, antibodies in the urine, you know. It's interesting.
I guess you probably have to do it sort of at a homeopathic level, though. You wouldn't want to drink liters of it every day.
And there's lots of data on that, you know, especially in India, actually.
Yes. Yeah. Well, but this is actually leading to some serious things to think about from your perspective as a nutritional educator and stuff like that.
Yeah, look, we only like the body, like what I always say to people. The people think they can store up on things, but the body has no storage, not real good. There's a few minerals that the body stores, which is calcium, right? There is, there's a few other, but the main one is calcium in our bones. But the rest, really, the body needs to actually take as it goes. So that's why we need to continuously eat a very balanced diet, because the body doesn't store things. So there's not a thing where you can just eat up on vitamins and supplements and think, oh yeah, I'm fine now for the rest of the month. It doesn't work that way. And actually the rest the body doesn't at that moment doesn't need gets passed through. So for example, most of the nutrients will still be in your feces or in the urine that you don't need.
Yes.
So that's why, you know, a lot of the supplements end up in your toilet.
Well, this could be the new mining industry.
Oh, hey, there's lots of people around.
Cess mining.
Well, I'm sure you can extract a lot of things from the exposits.
Okay.
Anyway.
So now let's talk about Elon Musk.
Hi, Elon.
Is he going to like living on Mars?
Depends on the nightlife, I guess. I mean, I think, any place has good and bad bits, right? I mean, I'm sure it could be a great colony if only cool people go up there.
Well, I liken it. Did you ever see that film, Dr. Strangelove?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Remember, they were gonna have a whole lot of attractive women down in the bunker with them for procreation purposes. So I figured Elon's going to be a step ahead.
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, obviously, he doesn't have that kind of reputation. I would say if he has a big server and a fast internet connection, he'd be happy with that, right?
Well, Monsanto might be contributing some playmates as well.
And they're called now BASF or something.
What was that?
No, Bayer. Bayer bought them, right? Yeah, the German company.
Oh.
But look, I think I'm in two ways about Elon Musk. I think he's a very prolific thinker, and he has a really good grasp on the affairs. Especially I liked his responds to AI very much, where he's tried to tell people.
He goes like, look at me, it was a success.
Well, he actually warned people about AI, and he really tried to warn people. He tried to talk to people and slow it down, and he was unsuccessful in that.
Well, what does he use to put his rockets and satellites into space?
Well, no, he's not against AI. He's just really wanting people to know about the danger of it.
Yes.
And no one talks about AI. We're programming them every day, each person.
Well, but it's running off the rail like everything. We've got weapons technologies now that are completely automated. I mean, even back in the day in the 1970s, when you've got all the nuclear weapons are controlled by computers. They have what's called launch on warning. Assured destruction. These are all archaic, terms. But it's like, a lot of it, like I was saying yesterday, I think a lot of the stuff, we're out of the loop now. The decision making of a lot of this stuff.
So, I mean, even like the camera you're holding is full of AI, like keeping my face in focus, and things like that.
There's a little box around your face
is
right
it?
Now.
So AI is working. See? It's good, isn't it? You know how much work that was like 10 years back when you actually have to manually, some person has to pull it. We had like long, measuring tape running from the camera to the person's face.
Keeping it focused.
I guess it was AI too, but like it was biological AI.
There was analog intelligence.
Analog AI. Not so much intelligence, I guess.
Now here's a question that'll segue into our next topic. Mm-hmm. Mars's atmosphere is 95% carbon dioxide.
Mm-hmm. Someone had to breath out a lot.
So exactly. So what's their climate change scenario?
I guess get some plants there. They would love it.
It's also extremely cold.
I guess.
And the ultraviolet index is like off the scale.
Yeah. Here we go on the ground.
But Elon Musk is serious about going to live there. But how will he make it through the Van Allen radiation belts?
Maybe just a clone of him.
Well, now we're getting somewhere. Mm. How many are there?
True. I mean, the work he's doing, I mean, he's at Tesla, at Rocket SpaceX, and he has this mining company. So it must be at least three of them.
He has a mining company. Is it doing deep seabed mining for all the rare earth metals?
They should probably ask him for expertise because he's really good into digging.
What's the name of his company?
Isn't it called the mining company or something?
Really? I never knew about that.
Yeah.
But I know that they're...
Well, they're for digging, those tunnels for his tunnel project, the Hyperloop.
Now, tell me about that.
Well, his idea of changing transport is with all these little tunnels where people...
Down in the ground.
Yeah, well, I mean, it makes sense. Look, we live in a 3D world, right? So we don't have a one-dimensional... We're living in actually... Sorry, I mean, we're going up, with our offices, with our residential units, but we only have one-level streets. So that doesn't work. It builds up traffic. So what he's saying is, we have to go down with our tunnels to create more lanes.
We've got to get down.
Get down, big time.
So are you a true believer in progress as traditionally defined?
Look...
Starting from where we are now and continuing.
Look, I've actually questioned that in myself a lot in terms of, a lot of people that I meet in the activist realm, they have a lifestyle of being an activist. They want to go back to the simple life. They want to do gardening. They want to do all that.
But they want to keep their mobile phone.
Even that they will give away. I think there are some people who truly just say, look, I'm going to give everything away and live in a cave. I'm not one of them, right? So I'm kind of thinking, look, I grew up with Star Trek, right?
You're going to live long and prosper.
Exactly. So I loved that vision.
Yes.
I loved that vision.
But you know what? They never went to the bathroom. Did you ever see a crew of the Star Trek go to the restroom?
Well, their nutrition was so optimal that they didn't have any... It was just perfectly timed, you see?
I didn't mean to derail you.
But look, I love the vision of it to have certain, our needs, Maslow, kind of that pyramid. If we can kind of solve a lot of these issues and we can look at growth as a species, as humanity, as our from our spirituality, I think it could be an interesting thing. And I reckon it. I mean, look, a lot of these things from Star Trek have become reality.
Yes.
So a lot of the technology is in development or I mean, that's why I was thinking, where the writers are, these are the visionaries, the prophets of our time. So we had, like, when we look at back into history, there were always prophets. And sometimes I ask, where are our prophets? Where are the prophets gone? So, well, I think they're still there, but there might be our fictional, you know, science fiction writers.
Elon Musk is one of the founders of PayPal.
Yeah. PayPal.
I use that.
Look, it's smart. You know, I think anything that disrupts an industry actually is good, I think, to understand there is progress. From an engineer perspective, I talked to some really good engineers and inventors. And the one thing that really impressed me was that they were saying a lot of everything that is currently on this planet can be improved. Everything.
Especially us.
Yes. Maybe just a little bit. No, a couple.
That's Ray Kurzweil. You know who he is.
Yeah, he plays beautiful music.
Well, he invented that.
That's right.
You know what his first major invention was?
No.
It was a machine that could take a book and read it out loud.
Huh.
For blind people to hear.
Very good. Yeah. He was obviously very interested in vibration, I guess, as well. But I think...
But he claims that he's going to... He doesn't go, I'm going to extend my lifespan indefinitely. He goes like, I'm going to live forever. And I go like, but look, man, how do you know when you're there to forever? What comes after that?
Forever is a long time.
It is. How long is it? This long.
Very long. And look, we looked at... I mean, look, the question is, if you're the only one that lives forever, is that really... Hey,
well, there's been
have fun there's alone.
There's been twilight zones.
That's right, yeah. Exactly. So, where were we? I was thinking about the engineers and inventors. So everything on this planet can be improved. The question is, can it be only slightly improved, or are you really thinking how to improve it greatly? And that's the thing, that a lot of inventors and engineers are very driven by product cycles right now, and are driven by, they're lazy.
Well, how could they not be?
Because, yeah, they have to kind of make it work, right?
But somebody's funding their operations.
Yeah, so, but I think they should be funded on the actually percentage of improvement. And
well, do you think that there's people that truly believe that our mentality, our mental operating environment can be improved upon?
Mental operating, look, that is really...
But to me, that's something that always has to come on a one-to-one, do-it-yourself basis, not something that can be imposed or engineered or orchestrated by those who wish it as well. You know what I'm saying?
Look, the mental construct is really a result of your accumulative influences in your life. So I'm always fascinated, like, to see what people, like, why do we know this is a table, right? And
you mean this hippopotamus here?
Yeah. it's black, right? Yeah, so
it looks like a rainbow colored.
Yeah, so it's kind of really, and then again, when you look deeper and smaller, again, if you go,
there's nothing there. It's mainly just space.
Exactly, it's a space. So we live in a big space with nothingness, and there's this importance put onto whatever we do or say. It's a strange thing. I mean, the concept of ego, I find a very interesting one, and then the reaction of our ego to things that other people say. Like space to space, right? So there's two spaces talking to each other and getting angry about too much space or too little space.
Well, but when people talk about the ego, they forget that Freud had two other essential dimensions, the id and the superego. They're all equally going at the same time.
Yeah. You know,
and so I think a lot of our reality is sort of like a battle of ids.
Is, yeah, I don't have that concept right. I know the superego, but I don't...
It's kind of the lower unconscious stuff.
Okay,
that, no. that you don't really... It's like the Dr. Jekyll. It's like the Mr. Hyde version of the Dr. Jekyll.
Well, I always were interested...
All the stuff that you always wanted to do, but nobody let you.
Well, it's interesting because I kind of had the idea of starting a subconscious community.
I'm already a member.
Oh, yeah? Let's go to sleep and meet. You know, that's an interesting thing, because what is our subconscious? And then there was two law professors I had a conversation with, and they basically said that the subconscious actually makes the decision and the conscious is only the executive. So if that will be true, then, you know, obviously from our legal system, how could we actually blame our consciousness if everything is controlled by the subconsciousness? So,
well, that this lends a whole new meaning to what we loosely define as the New World Order.
Hmm. Well, I mean, Matrix, I guess it was a film that kind of, I think influenced me at the time as well to go into filmmaking, because I was very groundbreaking storytelling in terms of, and also the concept of it, I guess, living in a, literally having a world just being put in front of you and you computing in it. I mean, I guess...
Whereas the reality is you're laying in this thing in the coffin with all these tubes coming out of you.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty plausible. I mean, it's almost there, right? We're living in little boxes and we're watching TV and we still get our own food, unfortunately, but that can be solved.
Well, my dream is that maybe with the help of Monsanto, if they see the light, they can help us photosynthesize so that we don't have to eat food anymore. We can make our own and have green hair.
Well, exactly. I mean, there's actually, you know, the interesting fact for that, we actually, through evolution, have actually lost a lot of our synthesizing potential. We used to be able to, and that's very interesting, actually, in terms of why are there so much high cancer rates and all that kind of stuff. We actually have less and less self-synthesizing potential in terms of our vitamin D. In the Paleolithic area, because they were eating highly meat protein, but they were very, very, very healthy. The same as at the moment, for example, when they do tests of pharmaceuticals with rats, they actually are a species, they can synthesize their own vitamin C.
For real?
Yeah. And that's why they don't react in the same way against medication in humans. So if they do the same test on guinea pigs, they would die.
What does that tell you? How many experiments have they done on rats and assumed that it would have the same effect on us because we're mammals?
Exactly. Well, they can't. Now, it's very hard to do human studies, right?
Yes. Well, look, now I want to...
They've done that.
I want to ask you, if you're, are you A climate denier, B, a climatologist, C, a climatosophy guru, or D, none of the above?
I would say, first of all, probably none of the above, actually. I'm still a work in progress. And
where do you stand on all that?
Yeah, I'm definitely seeing the impact that humankind has on this planet. And I want humanity to stop using fossil fuels because it's not healthy. It's if you sit in your car and you put a hose in it, I don't think you're going to make it for 10 hours, right? So the burning process, why do people die from smoke, right? I mean, literally, we're burning that stuff up, or we're producing toxins. And I see that as well as my work in nutritional medicine. Like, we have people full of toxins, hydrocarbons, plastics, formaldehydes.
Well, everything from oil is toxic.
Exactly.
Biological life.
So it is not really... makes sense, right? I mean, there's plenty of stuff we can use that is non-toxic. So, and maybe we don't use that much stuff. I mean, I don't know. But
what I pull back to, regardless of all the climate change ideology and stuff like that, I go like, you know, even if the mainstream ideology was true, nothing about climate change, except for the what you're talking about, but the climate change thing itself does not create cancer or mutagens or teratogenesis like the toxins do. You know, a few degrees of temperature, sea level rise, some weird weather and stuff like that. That's not genomic warfare.
No, there has been climate change throughout the history of this planet.
If you've got a climate, it's going to change.
Exactly. So, you know, there's weather patterns, I guess, that are changing. And there's no question
we're throwing a wrench into a living system that I think is conscious and it's unpredictable in how it might respond. It's not a machine.
No.
It's not a machine.
And I think we see the effects of our effect. Like, if you poke a stick into a bee nest, things will change, right? So I think we no doubt, I mean, I've seen the destruction of the environment in the third world. I've seen when they are unchecked, you know, when their mining companies, oil companies can do whatever they want and no one is there to basically speak up. I've seen, you know, glaciers retracting. I've seen the storms, the impact on storms. I've seen snow in April when there was snow. I mean, it's all been there. So I think there is definitely an effect on our weather patterns.
Well, and forgive me for interrupting, but to me it's important to acknowledge that even all this that you're saying so far could just be the sort of unintended side effect of military-industrial civilization. But when you add in the certain existence of weapon systems that are directly designed to influence people, that's what a lot of people have there. That's when you get put into the conspiracy theory box, when you bring up stuff like that. Yeah. But I think that's a real factor in the world. You know, and it's like the atom bomb was from 73 years ago.
Yeah. So there was obviously technology is there that can alter things, and the human brain has the capacity to invent things that are pretty out there
and to be altered.
Yeah, and to be altered as well. Yeah. Look, we know about plasticity, brain plasticity as well. You know, so we know that the brain changes, and neurons. I mean, still the very very fast shooting computer. You know, I mean it's. It's quite remarkable what the brain can actually do, create, and
my brain has a mind of its own.
That's right, especially, and it gets better with age, doesn't it?
Yes, well, absolutely. Well, look, now let me ask you the most important question of all. We're going to talk about the I word, intelligence. Mm-hmm. What does that mean to you?
Well.
Because we invented that concept as humans.
Yeah.
We use it as sort of like this gauge or a standard that we compare all other life forms. And it's a given that we've got the most of it. And then everybody else may or may have varying degrees. Would you say that's kind of how we look at it?
I look at intelligence actually already.
What does it mean?
Processed information.
But for what purpose?
Understanding. So the higher the intelligence, the better the intelligence, the better prepared you should be able to make better decisions.
Well, did intelligence allow us to create the atomic bomb?
That probably was a wrong use of intelligence.
Now we're getting into draw a distinction between wisdom and intelligence.
Yeah. Intelligence is for the highest bidder. Like, for example,
that's a good way to say it.
Yeah. So if I want intelligence on the best way to your heart, right? I can ask maybe all the people in your life that you've had contact with, and then provide a summary of that. And then I'll be able to use that intelligence, you know, to get
to create my dossier.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the thing, right? And then it could be either for good intention or for bad intention. So I think that's the thing. When someone asks, look, you know, give me all the intelligence on creating the best car in the world, the most efficient car, they will stop you and say, well, why would you want to do that? You know? So sometimes that is not really in the best interest of the people at hand, right? So because they're everybody making money off brakes, braking. I mean, it could be material that you don't ever have to change brakes in the whole lifetime of a car. Why does that parts? Why do we have printing? Why do we need cartridges? I mean, I know there's a lot of things, right? We could do many things better, but there is no profit in it. So intelligence, I guess, is a component to increase profit. And that is not always smart.
And isn't it ironic that the most profitable and lucrative and biggest industries in the world are those of weapons manufacturing?
Look, I think...
aimed at us.
Yeah, I thought the biggest industry in the world is, prostitution. I don't know. Isn't it?
No. It's the oldest.
It's the oldest, okay. Look, I think that we always... weapons. I think weapon actually it's really an interesting thing for a lot of people because you have unlimited budget to create whatever there is in your mind.
It is forgotten country.
And as long as it destroys something better than it was there before, it destroys
what's evil.
Exactly.
The evil enemy.
It's for the best.
Who deserves
for protection.
Deserves to get blown
and
up.
And for this, you know, God is. It's for God blesses them. You know?
But where's the justice in that? The justice in believing that something is your enemy when it's actually not. And just because you believe that it is, but if it's not, who's actually right? Where's the truth in that?
I don't think there is anyone questioning right or wrong. In the end, it doesn't really matter. I mean, if you look, it's really a spiritual question, a philosophical question in terms of, you know, I mean, I think weapons were always, it's more of a power, like what you want to, it's generally really, I mean, even like when you look at it first, I mean, if you had two tribes, and there's that one has more than the other, and now the jealousy and envy of the human emotions is a very strong force.
But they could just voluntarily share.
Yeah, but sharing is something that
came later?
Yeah.
You reckon? Did you see 2001, A Space Odyssey?
Yes.
Remember when they touched the monolith, the black monolith that represented the alien intelligence, and that ringing sound, and then the next time they had that encounter with the other beings, he picked up the bomb, and it became a weapon. That was the dawn of intelligence.
I guess the whales don't have any weapons, do they?
Well, they can use sound waves as a weapon.
I guess so.
Some of them can send out shock waves.
Okay.
With their beak.
They can ram you, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
Look, I think it requires a new kind of human. So that's the thing.
Ray Kurzweil?
Maybe. If he lives forever, and then he just becomes a keyboard.
He'll have to go back and say,
well, he goes, maybe he's already been here forever. Well, it'd be an interesting guy. I mean, imagine there would be already someone that has lived forever.
Did you meet him?
No. Is he an interesting guy?
I don't know.
Have you met him?
No, I don't want to.
Why?
He's going to be living on Mars with Elon.
Is he?
Absolutely. And Dr. Strangelove's going to... And Nikola Tesla's going to be there, too.
Okay.
He's been traveling around with aliens. On
Nikola
craft.
Tesla?
Yeah, he will not have aged today because he's been traveling at almost the speed of light.
Wow.
This is all in my satire that you should read.
Okay, I will, definitely. Yeah, I don't know. Look, it's...
So, but you now tell us more about the Star Trek thing.
Yeah.
Did you see that Patrick Stewart is going to come back as Jean-Luc Picard?
Finally.
But did you like the first generation of Star Trek, Captain Kirk? And
no, I actually like the new Next Generation.
Yep.
Yeah, I don't know. I know a lot of people like the original one. I'm.
Did you see the fourth movie though, where they had to go back in time and get some whales? Leonard Nimoy wrote that. It's actually really brilliant.
Is
it's
it?
Called the Journey Home.
Okay, Mom, I have to check that out again. I'm probably still worried about it. It's been a long time. Okay. No, I mean, it was just something that I think from living in the time where I grew up, where we had the Cold War going, you know, East against West, like the Russians against the Western, you know, NATO and Warsaw Pact. And we grew up there, and it was actually a vision of a future that I kind of, I'm not against like a global United Nations Council. I think it just has to be for the right intention. It can't be an economic union, or it can't be a power union just to add, you know, like the whole thing that's happening at the moment, like the whole intellectual property rights, all that, the trade agreements are only really helping the rich countries protecting themselves. And I think if we would, I mean, look, how can 90% of the wealth be governed by 1% of the human population? It's, to me, it's just not fair.
Well, are you familiar with the long-standing depopulation agenda that a lot of these elite people...
They're not really good at it, though.
They don't have any problem in talking about it. And some people go like, but look, it's not working, is it? But
maybe it is.
Well, because the way I look at it is, and again, whether by design and or inadvertent side effect, since World War II, when all the whole massive amounts of synthetic usages and carcinogens have come out, radiological toxicity, chemical toxicity, later on the whole thing with genetic engineering, when we're waging genomic warfare against ourselves, but it doesn't appear overnight.
No.
It takes generations.
Well, if you live forever, you have time.
Exactly. You've got time to mutate indefinitely. You might actually have time to come all the way back from the circle, exactly what you started out as, after every other permutation was exhausted.
I do think sometimes you cannot expect all the outcomes. You know, I think that is a lot of the times when you have an experiment, you don't know what the outcome is, because I think...
If you did, you wouldn't need to do it.
Exactly. So we have actually 80 million processes that go on every second in the body. I mean, how can you compute that? It's very difficult, and then it has all the correlations between that. That's why Yeah.
Our bodies are smarter than we are.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's also our best doctors, you know. So
if we let it, gives ourselves a chance to heal by removing the disease influence, which I was comparing that to human military industrial civilization in its present form on Mother Earth. Well, look, if you could say something right now that every person on the earth could hear and understand, what would that be?
I love you.
Say it again.
Let love rule.
How do you say that in German?
Lass Liebe siegen.
Lass Liebe siegen. Alexander, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure talking with you. Look, and so what else, what other kind of projects do you have going on now? You're deeply in, you just did some interviews today relating to, is this moving towards a more in-depth film project about this seismic thing?
Yeah.
Or are you getting stuff on local media?
Yeah, I mean, we have a lot of correlation with local media. We are running actually really an in-depth story on this whole mineral oil complex issue here on the seismic.
Will it be like an hour-long show?
Yeah.
Will it be aired on TV?
Probably, yeah.
If
we allow.
In order to not just be a NIMBY,
yeah,
you're going to have to take on the whole hydrocarbon industry of Australia.
Wow.
Are you up for it? Because I'll help.
Let's give it a
that
go.
Means we have to ride our bicycles everywhere.
Well, I have a solar panel on the top of my van. I mean, I would love to put a little electric motor in it. It would run on solar power, which would be good, but it would be hard.
But you see my point, though,
sure.
Right? We can't point fingers because we're all. If the oil companies shut down their service stations, people wouldn't be
scream.
Happy about
yeah.
it.
I mean, imagine just shutting down electricity at 8 at night. That would already solve our crisis. I mean, if the whole world would shut down at night the electricity, solved. But who would not riot? I mean, you can't watch your TV.
Well, people, if the bottle shops closed, the grocery stores closed,
right. No stadium lighting.
And the service stations closed, then people might be out in the streets.
And no one wants that.
No. But you know what my new motto is? Yep. I saw this on Facebook, of all places. A grateful heart is a for miracles. I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, I'm very grateful to be able to be a voice.
It's an inspiration to meet you. But we all do have a lot to be thankful for, don't we?
Yeah, we do. I mean, it's a magical life, and there's a lot of miracles in my life. I tend to attract the right moments, the right people at the right time, and be able to get in front and be able to pull through with what I want, you know, in terms of manifestation. And I think that's very important. And I'm just using my skills to be able to illuminate a dark corners of our society.
Well, look, man, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks.